Okay, let's start with the lecture proper. Wait a minute, where's my... here. Okay. I forgot my pointer. Let me put that in. Okay, week 12. Today's topic is how to do things with words. This title is stolen from one of the most important figures in speech act theory, from Austin. It's the title of a series of lectures where he basically formulated the ideas for the first time that have become the basis for the study of pragmatics. And I'm going to say a few words about what he did or what he proposed, particularly towards, well, at the beginning of the lecture. Before doing so, before doing so, the usual admin. Some of you may have seen that the second assignment is now online. I would like to remind you, and I'll also send round an email to everyone so that they're informed. I'd like to remind you again that this is only obligatory for BA students, but everyone is welcome to submit it. The deadline is the weekend in, well, not next week, obviously, but the week after, which will then give me enough time to mark it. Okay. It entirely consists of previous exam questions, okay, from the last year and 2 years ago. Yeah. So you get a good idea, and in fact the format is the same as the exam has been for the past 2 years. So you get a number of small questions or short questions at the beginning as the first part, and then you get a choice of two essay questions where you're supposed to answer with a short essay of about 100 to 250 words. Okay. I would recommend that you do this as an exercise for the exam. Okay. And I said, as I said last time, if you do it without consulting the literature, then you will get a good idea as to where you stand. Okay. The first assignment, I've now finally managed to finish the marking. The results will be online soon as well. I have to say I'm not quite sure whether I'll manage before I leave for the weekend. I'm going to have a whole weekend of music with the university orchestra, so I'm not sure whether I'll manage to upload things before that. But in any case, you can also pick them up again from Frau Thielen's office from Tuesday onwards. Okay, they're probably going to be there on Monday already, but I don't want to promise anything, so from Tuesday onwards. Yes, so the assignment is now marked, but there's some... I need to put it into an Excel sheet and those kind of things. I will also upload the solutions to StudIP. This is not a pass-fail situation, okay? So you don't have to worry about not having done sufficiently well and therefore not being allowed to take the exam. But if you have, 7 or 8 or 9 minus points, I basically counted minus points for things that weren't answered in the way that I expected them to be, then I think you need to rethink, or you need to go back to the drawing board and see whether you can look at those skills again, because you will need them further on in your studies. So, so it's an indication, again, for you as to where you stand. I think most of the answers that I'll be uploading will be sort of self-explanatory. I've been actually quite nasty marking them. If something wasn't 100% the way I expected it, I just counted it as wrong. I felt I could do this because it's not a pass-fail situation, but I wanted you to really know, yes, this is absolutely right or not. The only thing where I've been a little bit lenient, because I didn't want to be too nasty, was that I asked you to work with the Oxford English Dictionary online. Now, I'm not quite sure how you did this. Some of you might have put Oxford English Dictionary online in Google, and then, and you were at home perhaps, and then realized that one link didn't work and the other one did. The problem is that the one that did work, namely OxfordDictionaries.com, is not the Oxford English Dictionary online. It is dictionaries that are related to it or that are situated in Oxford, etc. But it's not the Oxford English Dictionary, the greatest dictionary of the English language that I used sometime earlier on in the lecture, I think lecture 1 and 2 I mentioned it. Okay. And I could see this because the etymology that you listed or that you gave me for coffee is the one that's from the website and not from the Oxford English Dictionary, whether it's online or in printed form. Yeah. So it's not wrong, but one of the reasons why I wanted to have you look into the Oxford English Dictionary online is because that is the definite dictionary and is something that you will be expected to know how to use later on in your studies. So I would very much recommend that you check things in the Oxford English Dictionary rather than in other dictionaries. Okay. I'm not talking about you using a dictionary for essay writing or something like that. Other dictionaries are fine. But if you want to find out something about the history of a word, or if you want to sort of have the definite answer from a dictionary point of view, the OED is just the place to go. Okay. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, but as I said, the answers will be uploaded as well. If there are any questions, then please contact me, either by email, or I can repeat what I said before, my office hours. Yeah. I'm not sure whether I've ever seen anyone from the first semester. Yeah, possibly, I can't remember now, but very, very few people actually come and talk to me. Okay. Good. Let's do some linguistics then. And the question I would like to ask first is a very basic question in many ways. What do we use language for? If you went out on the street and asked a person who is not linguistically trained what we use language for, then the most likely response I think we would get is to convey information. So we could perhaps want to know when a particular train is leaving, or we could just basically make a statement like this: the train will leave at 11:24 from platform 7. Yeah. And by doing this, I am conveying information, no doubt. Yeah. And in fact, if it's later than 11:24, I could even say whether it indeed left on time, although it's not quite clear what on time means, as you know. And I can evaluate whether this is true or not. Yeah. So both those sentences I can look at and say, yes, true or not true. Okay. But that's not the only reason why we use language. We use language for all sorts of other reasons. And I would like to make one particular point in how we can use language other than convey information. Now, the two of you there sitting in front, sometimes I do this in lectures, I'm sure you can take it, I hereby pronounce you husband and wife. Okay? After the lecture there will be a celebration because we have a new couple, husband and wife. Yes, let's give them a... Okay. Good. Now, is it true, in a way I'm already jumping ahead, yeah? Is it true that by saying this, I am actually performing an action? Well, as I said, I'm jumping ahead. In a way, yes and no. Okay. First of all, let's answer the question, is this a question about true or false? No. Yeah? This is not... We can't look at, I hereby pronounce you husband and wife, and say true or false. So it sort of simply doesn't apply. But are those two married now? Obviously not. Why not? Well, I'm a linguistics professor, I'm not a pastor. Okay. My father was a pastor, but that doesn't help. Okay. We're not in church. They probably don't want to get married. We don't know, but very likely not, I would say. Okay. One of them or both of them might be married already. Yeah. So in other words, if it was in the right situation, if I was the right person, if they wanted to get married, if they weren't already married, etc., etc., you get the point, they would not be married. Yeah? And simply by using language, by using the words, I hereby pronounce you husband and wife, I would have performed the act of marrying them. With language. Yeah? I haven't, because the necessary conditions aren't fulfilled. Yeah? In technical terms, the appropriateness conditions aren't fulfilled. So, I am not qualified to do this. Few people are qualified to do this. Usually, people who work, well, either in the church or in some official, what's the word now? I have a blackout. The registry office, etc., where civil marriages are performed. Okay. Perhaps the captain of a ship can do it as well under the right circumstances. So, yes, the circumstances must be appropriate. So, not only the right person, but the right circumstance. Okay. And there is a procedure that needs to be followed correctly and completely. And I'll illustrate this in a minute, what I mean by correctly and completely. And as we said, you really ought to want to get married in order to get started. Okay. Let's have a look at this. This is an old form of the marriage procedure. Nowadays, the words are slightly adapted, but it's basically one way of marrying someone. If I were the priest, I could say, whoever, well, let's say, I don't know, X, the name, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honor, and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, keep thee unto her so long as ye both shall live. Okay? And then the future husband will say, yeah. Yes. No, right? That's not the proper way of completing the marriage vows. Okay? I will is what he is supposed to say. And if he doesn't, then in a way something isn't completed, and that will perhaps endanger the whole act in the sense that the marriage is not legal, not complete. Again, this is a question of words. So, in fact, with words we seem to be able to decide on rather, well, momentous facts of life. If we do it right, then an act is performed. But if the appropriateness conditions or the procedure is not fulfilled, then we might have a problem. Now, of course, it was a joke to try to marry those two in front here. But this can be quite real. Okay. This is from a Swiss newspaper. This is a newspaper clipping where something in this sense went a little, or in this well, something similar went slightly wrong. I'll just read that to you. Eine im oberbayerischen Kreiburg aus Spaß geschlossene Ehe hat für die beiden Partner doch keine ernsthaften Folgen. Das Landesratsamt erklärte den Lebensbund am Montag offiziell für ungültig. Im August hatte Bürgermeister Alois Schlagmann laut Zeitungsberichten nach einer feuchtfröhlichen Geburtstagsfeier der Festgemeinschaft das Rathaus gezeigt. Und dort spaßeshalber eine Trauungszeremonie vorgenommen. Da der Bürgermeister auch als Standesbeamter tätig sein kann, war zunächst unklar, ob es sich um eine gültige Ehe handelte. Das vermeintliche Brautpaar und die Zeugen haben schriftlich erklärt, dass keine Eheschließung stattgefunden hat, sagte der zuständige Sachgebietsleiter im Landratamt Mühldorf, Erich Kotzel, I guess, I don't know. Damit ist die Sache für uns erledigt. Andernfalls hätte sich das Brautpaar erst nach einem Trennungsjahr wieder scheiden lassen können. Okay? So, it was a close shave. Okay? And simply because all the right things were there, they were probably drunk enough to want to get married. I don't know. Yeah? So, these can have real legal ramifications. Okay? And again, language is part of the game. Okay? So uttering the right words at the right time may be dangerous. In fact, uttering the wrong words at the right time may also be dangerous. This is something which happened on board a Silk Air, Singapore Airlines, a Singapore company, I think it is, airplane. Man fined for making bomb joke aboard a Silk Air aircraft. An Australian man has been fined $10,000, that's quite a bit of money, I think about 6,000 or 7,000 euros nowadays, under international anti-terrorism regulations after making a joke about a bomb on board a Silk Air flight. The man was looking for hand luggage space on board the Silk Air aircraft on a flight bound for Indonesia when he asked a flight attendant, "Where do you keep the bomb?" According to the Straits Times. The pilot was informed of the incident, after which the man was removed from the aircraft and later charged with raising a false alarm about a terrorist act. The man had faced up to 5 years in jail and a maximum of $100,000 fine, although he told the court his comment was meant as a joke. Okay. So that pretty much points to one important fact. Language in context can get you, well, number one, into trouble or married, which may be the same thing, but anyway, we are actually doing things with language. It's not about conveying information, but it's really an act. Okay. Notice, by the way, that this act here, which was interpreted to mean, well, I have a bomb and I'm threatening you with it, has a particular form. It's presented in the form of a question. Where do you keep the bomb? Okay. Let's have a quick look at forms of such speech acts. From now on, I'm going to call it speech acts because we're using spoken language, or we're using language to perform an act. I could, for example, at the beginning of a meeting that I'm chairing, okay, I can only do this when I'm chairing it, say, "I declare the meeting open." Or, if I'm the right person, I could name the ship Victoria by saying, "I name the ship Victoria." And if I've got a nice bottle of champagne and if I'm throwing it at the boat, then the ship will be named Victoria afterwards, or will have the name Victoria. I sentence you to life imprisonment. Or, I apologize for deceiving you. Okay. Now, all four of those utterances perform an action. Namely that of opening a meeting, christening a ship, etc., etc. And that's got to do with the form, in some way, of those utterances. In fact, I can make it very clear that these are performative utterances by adding the word hereby. I hereby declare the meeting open, I hereby name the ship, etc. Yeah. And by uttering this, if I can say this, then the act is performed, given the right appropriateness conditions. Notice that this is not possible with all verbs. I cannot say, "I hereby insult you." Yeah? That's because there is no English verb that, by being uttered, performs the action of insulting. Yeah? Now, obviously, I can insult you with language, but I will not do this with the performative verb, as it's called, insult. Okay. Here is a little interlude. "Nothing is more fierce than my hatred for cats. I despise the very ground on which they walk." Okay, bit of sniffing going on. I do believe a cat has walked along here. Yes, I'm sure. "I hereby despise this ground." Okay, that doesn't work. There is no performative verb despise. Now, I've already, a couple of times, used the term performative verbs. That goes back to, as I said, Austin, who in the 1950s formulated these ideas, and he looked at what he called performatives, in the sense of performative utterances. So if I say, I promise to give you the bunny back tomorrow, then by using the speech act verb or the performative verb promise, I perform a promise. Now, Austin thought a bit further than that, and he looked at how language is used beyond those cases where we have such verbs like apologize or christen or, I don't know, the ones that I've just listed. And he said, is it really different when I say, I'll give you the money back tomorrow? There is no word promise. But isn't this just as much a promise? It just doesn't contain the necessary verb. It performs the same action. It binds me towards whoever is listening, in the sense that this person can expect to receive the money back. Here's another example that is straight from Austin. I warn you, in fact, I hereby warn you, that a bull is about to attack you. Okay? By the time that utterance has been uttered, the bull has probably already attacked the poor man or the poor woman. Yeah? It would be much more economical, life-saving, I guess, to just shout, bull! Yeah? Same action being performed, I'm sure you agree. Yeah? So, quite clearly, actions with language can also be performed without using these explicit performative verbs. The question to ask then is how we make sense of an utterance that doesn't have these explicit performative verbs. How do we know it's a warning? How do we know it's a threat? How do we know it's a promise or an apology? So Austin looked at how language is used and he came to the conclusion that all utterances involve some kind of actions. So all utterances are in fact speech acts. Some of them are clear speech acts in the sense that they are requests, commands, apologies, etc. But there is also a speech act which is called an assertion. I, by uttering the sequence, the train left at 11:24 from platform 7, perform the action of asserting something. So he came to the conclusion that it doesn't really make sense to distinguish between sentences that can be true and false and those that perform, because all of them perform. He doesn't deny that there are sentences or utterances which are true or false. But that's not his point. He's interested about the fact that we do things with words. And in fact, there are three types of act that are usually mentioned in this connection. namely, the locutionary act, which is, in a way, the act of here, the utterance of a sentence with determinate sense and reference. It's basically what the individual parts of the sentence or the utterance actually mean. Okay? It's the basic content of the sentence, looking at the semantics of the individual parts. Okay? For example, if I say, this is a table, and I refer to the table here, then this is a straightforward locutionary acts. But there are also illocutionary acts. And this is making using language to perform an act. The making of a statement, offer, or promise in uttering a sentence by virtue of, and this will for the time being sound a little bit theoretical, but I think I'll make it clear in a moment, by virtue of the conventional force associated with it. So in a way, the locutionary act is, to put it in a very lay fashion, what I'm saying, but the locutionary act is what I'm doing with it. And that may not be the same thing. There is also the perlocutionary act, which is the effect of what this has on the speaker, etc. This is not discussed further here because it's got less to do with linguistics. I'm interested in the locution, the direct way of, let's say, naming or referring, and the indirect elocutionary act of performing a speech act. Okay, I said I want to make this clearer. We need to look at some examples. You may, I don't know, maybe internally think this, or you may talk to someone and shout at that person and say, "Finish the lecture." Okay. In fact, we can look at this utterance and we can look at two things. We can look at the form, just as much as we did in syntax. We can look at the form and we can look at the function. We can look at whether it is a declarative, an imperative, etc. In this case, in fact, is an imperative. And then we talk about the sentence type. This is, in a way, a syntactic category. But we can also look at what it typically does. And maybe you can agree with me that if you walk up to someone and shout, "Finish the lecture," then that's a command, most prototypically. You could also ask a question. Have you finished the lecture? That is a different syntactic form. It's an interrogative rather than an imperative. And the speech act performed typically by this would be that of asking a question of, well, inquiry. And the most common speech act here perhaps, or also the most typical sentence type, is that of a declarative, "The lecture is finished," which is an assertion. So form on the one hand and function or act on the other hand. That, I think, is fairly straightforward, but there is a but. If I say, "Give me a hand," then this is an imperative, right? No problem with that. But what is the speech act? If I use an interrogative form, let's put it like that, by uttering, "Can you give me a hand?" then it's clearly interrogative, I just said that. But what's the speech act? If I use a declarative to say, "I can't do this alone," what is the speech act? Now, "Give me a hand" is a request, typically. "Can you give me a hand?" is a request, with a slightly different form, or in fact quite dramatically different form. Imperative versus interrogative are two different modes. Okay. And "I can't do this alone," well, can be interpreted as a request. If we look at the level of directness, then I'm sure you agree that "give me a hand" is very direct. If I ask you, "Can you give me a hand?" well, what am I doing here? I'm really asking you for your ability, for your physical ability to give me a hand, to help me. But of course, as I said, it's a request, but it's a slightly more indirect request. And "I can't do this alone" is even more indirect. It is, in fact, and that's a term that I'll be using again next week, off-record. Off-record in the sense that if you don't want to help me, and then say, "Oh no, I can't help you again," I say, no, "I just said I can't do this alone. I didn't ask you to help me." Yeah? So I give the hearer an opportunity to say, "That's not what I meant." I'll give you another example of the same principle. If A says, "Oh no, I forgot to bring my wallet," what does that mean? Well, on the one hand, the propositional content, the direct meaning, so to speak, is that he forgot his wallet. Fine. What if B says, "Oh, not again. This is the second time this week that you're asking me for money." Well, A can say, he's probably lying, or he's probably, we don't know, that's the point. hey, I didn't ask you for money, I just said I forgot to bring my wallet. Yeah? So in other words, the speech act, which is interpreted by B, namely a request for money, can be cancelled or can be denied ever to have happened by the speaker. Why do we do this? Why wouldn't I just say, give me some money? Well, because one is more polite than the other. It also depends on various factors. It's one way of being polite in a lay sense, okay, in the sense of, well, let's be polite and, I don't know, get up in the bus for other people or open doors and things like that. That is sort of the lay meaning of polite, but it's also polite in the linguistic sense, and I'll be talking much more about that next week. What does it depend on how direct or indirect you want to be? Okay. If you, I mean, it's quite easy to imagine, I guess, if you want to borrow some money from your wife, from your new wife, then you will probably use different language from coming up after the lecture and trying to get some money out of me. Yeah? I might give you some, I don't know, but you would ask differently. You would ask differently because you know your neighbor better than you know me on a different personal level, etc., etc. Yeah? So, there are factors like power. Okay? If there is a power relationship, if you ask someone who has more power, however you define power, then it's different from the person who has more power to ask something of someone who is lower on the power scale. Okay? Also, social distance. I am not your best buddy. Okay? You will therefore talk to me differently from talking to your best friend. Mm-hmm.
I do not understand why the consequence of more power is less kindness.
If I am your boss, I have power over you in some way. Yeah? Let's say you're my secretary. Let's say I have a meeting after the lecture and I would like you, I need some coffee, okay? Now my secretary doesn't usually do coffee for me, I just wanted to say. But this would be a situation where I could ask you to do that for me. And as my secretary, I can do this in a fairly direct way. Now imagine you're not my secretary, that for whatever reason I single you out as the person who wants to get some coffee for me afterwards. Yeah? This is a completely different situation. I don't have that power over you, okay? Or if I go up to the president of the university, or I don't know, I meet Frau Merkel in the street and ask her to get some coffee for me. Yeah? This is a question of a difference in power. And it will influence the directness or the indirectness of how I interact with you. Okay? Also, it will differ on whether I'm asking you for one coffee or whether I'm asking you to, I don't know, give me your car for the next 5 years. Okay? So, the size of the imposition is important too. Now, I'll be talking much more about politeness and about these principles of indirectness, etc., next week. Okay. But I already wanted to introduce one or two of those aspects because they really are based on the fact that we're doing things with language. Okay. You may also know this one here. I think Claire Fielder has it on her door, if I'm not mistaken. So, this is, of course, in a way, the prototypical cliché view of English politeness. So, it's wrong to just shout for help, but if you say, excuse me, sir, I'm terribly sorry to bother you, but I wonder if you would mind helping me a moment, as long as it's no trouble, of course. And the Brits are supposed to be very polite people who use this a lot more than other cultures, which is probably, well, stretching the point a little bit here, but yes, it also makes the point that these are The level of directness may in fact be culture specific. The principle is universal, but the way it is realized in each culture might differ. Okay, I've already talked about different ways of getting something done. Okay, and before I look at how it actually works, I would like to give you just a bit more of an impression of what I mean by saying that different forms may perform the same action. I could say close the door. This is a very direct way of uttering an act, a request. In fact, I could say I want you to close the door, which is a statement. Yeah? It's not an imperative. I'd be much obliged if you close the door. Can you close the door? So in a way I'm asking for you whether you're physically able to do this. Are you able by any chance to close the door? Would you mind closing the door? Would you be willing to close the door? All slightly different in their directness or on their level of imposition, etc. It might help to close the door. Slightly different again. Which you might offer if I was to ask you to close the door. Did you forget the door? Yeah, performs exactly the same. Now it gets more and more extreme in the sense that it differs further and further from the sort of prototypical basic propositional content. Do us a favor with the door, love. What does it do? It asks whoever is addressed to close the door. How about a little less breeze? It's becoming rather difficult to immediately see the connection between the words uttered and the speech act of request. The last two are my favorites. Now, Johnny, what do big people do when they come in? Yeah. And, okay, Johnny, what am I going to say next? Yeah. Which, in the right context, means close the door. But I'm not saying close the door. I'm only performing an action of closing. No, not closing the door. Of requesting someone to close the door. Okay? So, this basic meaning of an utterance, the propositional content, the sum of the meanings of the semantics, some of the meanings of the words used, etc., whatever you want to call it, may in fact be extremely different from what it actually does, or what it means in the sense of what it performs. And context is everything. Okay? So pragmatics is the study of language and meaning in context. Okay? And given the right context, an utterance, any utterance, can mean absolutely everything. You just need to come up with the right context. I can probably come up with a context where my uttering it's 3 o'clock means I bought a Ferrari yesterday. Okay? I haven't tried, but I'm sure we could come up with one. So there is a potentially complete separation of form from meaning, or of form from action. Now, of course, it's not true that there is no connection. There are more likely interpretations. There are more likely connections in the sense that an imperative is likely to be a request. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if that's actually the case with inside jokes.
With
inside jokes.
With inside jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the study of jokes is one subfield, or can be one subfield, of pragmatics, and a lot of the what is funny relies on what we would standardly interpret something to mean, but in fact don't. But it could, and what you're saying is basically the opposite. I have to think about that. But yes, I'm sure that is very context specific, and therefore may mean that someone sees it as a joke, even though other people who don't see the meaning behind it can't. Yes. Yeah, I would say so. But I'm not a specialist in jokes. There are some very good studies by a colleague in the Saarland, in Saarbrücken, Professor Norick. He's working on the study of jokes, and he has a lot to say about that. Okay, I'd like to introduce a technical term, namely that of entailment. Okay. If I say that Ian drives a Toyota, that's one utterance, one statement. Okay. And the second one is Ian drives a car. What is the relationship between the two? Well, we can say that A entails B. This is a logical relationship, based on the assumption that any Toyota is a car, of course. Okay. If Toyota starts making, I don't know, lawnmowers, then we have a problem. But as long as any Toyota is a car, then if I say A, I automatically, and I can't change that, say B. Well, not say, but entail B. So, whenever A is true, B must be true. In a situation like this, when I say something, then from the hearer's point of view, the conclusion can be drawn in a very confident manner. So, to read off here, if you hear and believe X, and X entails Y, then concluding Y is completely safe. If someone tells me Ian drives a Toyota, I can safely assume that Ian drives a car. From the speaker point of view, it's a commitment. If I say that Ian drives a Toyota, I commit to saying, or commit myself to saying that he drives a car. I can't say he drives a Toyota but he doesn't drive a car without being illogical. Notice that entailment doesn't usually go both ways. You can't say, I'm sure Toyota would like this, but it's not true. Ian drives a car, therefore he drives a Toyota. Okay. Now let's look at this. There is smoke coming from that house. Okay. The house is on fire. Is that an entailment? Not really. It's a reasonable assumption, it's an interpretation, it's reading the signs, but they might be filming, someone might have forgotten the cooking, or whatever they were cooking on in the kitchen, and it's turned a little bit, well, it might then turn into a fire, of course, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the whole house is on fire. Okay? So this is not an entailment. This is something that we read into the connection between those two utterances. This is what we call an implicature. We draw a conclusion on the basis of what we see. Yep?
But that's an entailment the other way around.
Sorry?
That's an entailment the other way around.
Why should it be an entailment the other way around? I guess so. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it. I don't know. I mean, if it's on fire, yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering. I mean, there are some types of fire where there is no smoke, of course, but, I mean, if the house is on fire, then you would probably have smoke, yes. Yeah, I could live with that statement, but it's certainly not that if you see smoke that you know for sure, logically, that the house must be on fire. That's the main point. Okay. Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. To give you another example of this, let's assume we're having a party. It's the wedding party. Okay. Sorry to come back to that. Yeah. And then Sandy might say, we need someone to make some sort of fruit salad for the picnic. What if Tom says, I can make my family's favorite fruit salad? What is the implicature? What's the implicature if someone says, I can make my family's favorite fruit salad? Mm-hmm. Sorry? It's an offer. Okay, it's an offer in that sense, yes. Okay, so we read the... we read into the statement that the person can do it, we read this as an offer. Okay, that's an implicature. True. What other things are implied? That it's supposed to be good. Okay? Has he done it before? Probably done it before, but do you know? Is that it? Yeah? You don't know. But you sort of assume, right? Yeah? Now, it actually turns out that this fruit salad was a catastrophe. Yeah? Everyone's having a stomach ache afterwards, and it just tasted absolutely horrible. Is it cancelable? Is it defeasible? Can Tom say, I never said I'd done it before. I just say I offered. You read that. I mean, you interpreted that correctly. But I never said that I am physically able to do this in the sense of, well, actually, he said can. Okay, no. But I never said that it was good, and I never said that I've done it before. No. This is an implicature. It's a standard way of interpreting an offer, of course. No. But it may not be exactly, well, our interpretation may in fact be wrong. No. Because we're basically interpreting the words that are uttered as one particular speech act and the things that belong to it. Okay, the person who took over from Austin in many ways and developed this theory of speech act is Paul Grice. What I'm going to tell you now is based on lectures that he delivered at Harvard in 1967. They're only partly published. There are some publications by him, but it's not that the whole lecture series was published. We've already had a few examples of situations where there was a huge discrepancy between what was said and what was meant or what was done with it. Like the what do people do with the door when they come in? Okay. So what he basically wanted to find out was how this is possible and how is it possible that we still understand each other? Because it could also be a situation where we simply just don't understand each other anymore, and we do usually understand each other. There might be the occasional misunderstanding, but on the whole, we're pretty good at understanding each other. So, how is it possible to mean more than what is actually said? And the following examples are examples that are taken partly straight from Grice, and there is also a book on pragmatics by Levinson that is an introduction to pragmatics which tells more about Gricean pragmatics. So those are the examples from either Grice or from Levinson. One of those examples is, can you tell me the time? Well, the milkman has come. Okay, we don't have milkmen in this country, but in Britain we have milkmen, still some, people who come and just, well, put a little glass of milk, a bottle of milk, in front of your door every morning. Okay. Now, what does this really mean? How does it actually work? Well, if you look at A, this is a question. So really what it means is, do you have the ability to tell me the time? And B really means, the milkman came at some time prior to the time of speaking. And there is this sort of pragmatically interpreted particle, this well, which I can't really look at in more detail now. Or in fact, I can make this even more complicated. What really is happening? Do you have the ability to tell me the time of the present moment as standardly indicated on a watch? And if so, please do tell me. Yeah? No, I don't know the exact time of the present moment, but I can provide some information from which you may be able to deduce the approximate time, namely, the milkman has come. Okay? That's what's going on, presumably, when something as easy as those two utterances are uttered in succession. Okay. But how does this really work? How can we make sense of this also so quickly? Okay. Presumably, we are not all talking much more in our brains when we don't say things like, no, I don't know the exact time of the present moment, but I can provide them silently. Okay. So we seem to be able to interpret this very, very quickly. In a way, this is part of the explanation, I'd like to look at the meaning of and. You may not have wondered much about the meaning of and before. It's a very frequent word, and it's a coordinating conjunction. Okay. So we looked at and when we did the syntax bit, where we looked at coordinated sentences, compound sentences, and I said that and is a coordinating conjunction. What does and really mean? Well, look at this here. The Lone Ranger jumped on his horse and rode into the sunset. Okay? And the second one, the capital of France is Paris and the capital of England is London. Okay? Do you agree that both times we have, in a way, the same meaning of and? Well, yes and no. Why? Well, the question really is, I'm a bit confused now because I think I'm missing one slide. Why does and not mean the same thing? Well, what does and mean in the first case? Yes. And then. Okay? Is that the case in the second one? No. Okay? The capital of France is Paris and the capital of England is London is not and then the capital of England is London. I can say the capital of England is London and the capital of France is Paris and that's fine, but I cannot say the Lone Ranger rode into the sunset and jumped on his horse. Yeah? Because the meaning of and seems to be different. So if that's the case, do we have two meanings of and that we therefore need two dictionary entries for? One is just and, in sense of coordination, syntactic, and the other one is and then, so a temporal and. Does that really make sense? Another example. If I say the flag is white, we can imagine this. We have a flag that is a white sheet. Okay? I give up. White flag. Okay. But if I say the flag is white, red, and blue, then in a way the white in the second one doesn't mean the same white, because now it's really only partially white. Yeah? The area of the flag is the same white, but there is something a little bit more to it than just white. Now, it doesn't really make sense, people who were looking at this said, to treat these as polysemies. Treating such instances as ambiguities will result in an endless proliferation of senses. So what they proposed was that there are some basic, simple, stable senses. Okay, so rather, natural language expressions tend to have simple, stable, and unitary senses, but this stable semantic core often has an unstable, context-specific, pragmatic overlay, namely a set of implicatures. So the and in the Lone Rider jumped on his horse and rode into the sunset means exactly the same on one level than the capital, than in the capital's example. But on top of that, there is an interpretation which relies on the fact that before riding into the sunset, you need to jump on your horse. We read this, so to speak, into the context, or out of the context, really. That still doesn't quite explain why we really understand each other. Why you can make sense of things that seem to have nothing to do with what they mean. And Grice therefore came up with this idea of the cooperative principle. The cooperative principle is, or relies on the fact that we assume that there is some kind of overarching rule or set of rules or guidelines that help us in our conversations. Okay? And they express what he called the cooperative principle. Okay? The basic assumption is that speakers are cooperative. Okay? If I speak to you now, then I want to tell you something. I could start talking nonsense, and you would probably quite soon realize that I'm saying nonsense, but for a while you might try to make sense of my nonsense, because your assumption is I'm trying to tell you something that makes sense. Okay? So if I suddenly said the flood yesterday at Hamburg was really high, then you would wonder, what does this have to do with linguistics? You would probably see this as an example or whatever. Okay? And if I then kept talking about 20, 30 other things, then at some stage you would notice. But for quite a while, you would assume that I'm being cooperative. Okay. Now, being cooperative means, on one level, that's straight from the cooperative principle, make your conversational contribution such as is required at the stage at which it occurs, by the accepted purpose or direction of the talk exchange in which you are engaged. Okay, so this sounds very complicated, but it basically means do what's expected from you in a way, when you speak. And in order to do this, he says we follow four maxims. These are in a way rules, but please do not consider them to be rules that have to be followed. I'll say something about this after I introduce them. These four maxims have, four names. The first one is the maxim of quantity. And I always, when I present those, I like to ask people to find the joke which I think Grice put into this list of maxims. The maxim of quantity is, make your contribution when you speak as informative as is required, for whatever is necessary at the moment. And don't make it more informative than is required. So, say at least as much as is needed, but don't say more than is needed. Okay. Any joke here? No. Okay. Maxim of quality. Try to make your contribution one that is true. Yeah. Don't lie. Okay. Do not say what you believe to be false. Do not say that for which you lack adequate evidence. Joke? No, not really. Okay. Maxim of relation. Easy. Be relevant. Okay. So, anything that I'm saying now here in this lecture, if I'm giving a decent lecture, should be relevant. Okay. And you sort of assume that this is the case. Again, I think no joke, so it needs to be in the last one, I think. And that's the maxim of manner. Be perspicuous, which means avoid obscurity of expression. Avoid ambiguity. Be brief, which means avoid unnecessary prolixity. Be orderly. Okay. Where's the joke? Has anyone ever heard the word prolixity before? Well, it means the opposite of being brief. If you say be brief, avoid unnecessary prolixity, and I think you're not being brief. Yeah. So I think that's a tongue-in-cheek comment by Grice. Okay, so we've got those four principles. And the assumption is, and that's very important now, because that's what students sometimes mix up or confuse. The assumption is that we're being cooperative. Now, if any of those maxims seem not to be followed or appear not to be followed, then we assume that the speaker is still cooperative and try to make sense of what's going on. Yeah. So the general assumption is we are cooperative, and if it looks as if we're not cooperative, because any of the maxims like manner or quantity or whatever are violated, then I am still assuming that my counterpart is being cooperative. Okay, it's time for Calvin and Hobbes. Shown this to you already. Yeah. So here we have Calvin wrecking the coffee table. What does the mother really ask? Well, in terms of syntactic form, it's an interrogative. What are you doing to the coffee table? This is, in a way, obvious. I mean, he's looking at it, well, what am I doing? I'm hammering nails into it. Of course. Is this some kind of trick question? It's obvious. Okay. Now, on the assumption that the mother is cooperative, which in this circumstance might be a little bit difficult in the first place, but anyway, language-wise speaking, okay, the question doesn't make sense because she's asking something which is obvious. Yeah. She's in a way saying too much. The only way to make sense of the fact that she is saying too much is that she probably means something different. We need to read something into her violation of the maxim of quantity. Okay. Possibly also a violation of the maxim of quality. She's shouting. Why should she shout? Okay. So Calvin, under normal circumstances, would read the signs and read what's actually meant into her question, into her interrogative, okay, and interpret it as a command to stop immediately. But he doesn't. But that's Calvin. Okay, I'd like to give you more examples of this, and I'd like to divide these, as Levinson does, into two types. The sort of standard implicatures, which are very conventionalized, okay, and then the ones where we're really flouting the maxims, where we're really violating something. If I say to someone who's passing me, I've just run out of petrol, and that person says, oh, there's a garage just around the corner. What does be really mean? Well, the assumption is, and we can safely assume this if we're A and listened to B uttering this and assuming that he's cooperative, that the garage isn't closed and hasn't sold out of petrol, otherwise the speaker wouldn't be cooperative. Makes sense, doesn't it? If I say that Nigel has 14 children, then the general assumption, the standard implicature, is that Nigel has only 14 children. Well, it's quite a lot, but not 15. But theoretically, the statement Nigel has 14 children is compatible with a situation where he has 21. Purely from a logical point of view. But the standard implicature is that we say the maximum number. Okay. The flag is white. Well, the flag is white and does not contain any other colors. Well, it's maxim of quantity. Relevance, pass the salt. Well, we sort of assume that this means pass the salt now. And in fact, in 2 weeks' time when we're doing discourse analysis, then we'll come back to those sort of general assumptions. Such inferences, as it says here, are fundamental to our sense of coherence in discourse. Coherence is something that we discussed last week. If the implicatures were not constructed on the basis of the assumption of relevance, many adjacent utterances in conversation would appear quite unconnected. Remember last week at the end I said, that's the doorbell, I'm in the bath. That's not relevant. But we make it relevant by assuming that the sequencing makes some sense. So, more about this soon, in 2 weeks. And if I say, open the door, then that's one way of doing it. But I could also say, walk up to the door, turn the door handle clockwise as far as it'll go, and then pull gently towards you. Why would I want to do this? This is in a way not fully compatible with the maxim of manner. Well, I want you to pay particular attention. Okay. Now, these were examples of the four maxims in sort of standard situations and standard implicatures. We can also really flout them. Flout in this meaning violate them. We could, for example, say that Queen Victoria was made of iron. Well, no, obviously she wasn't. I'm lying. I'm really saying something which just cannot be true. And we interpret this to mean, why does it make sense for someone to say that a human being was made out of iron? Well, presumably we want an interpretation of some of her qualities. So, Queen Victoria lacked the definitional properties of iron, obviously, she was a human being. She merely had some of the incidental properties like hardness, resilience, non-flexibility and durability. Okay. Notice, by the way, that it's interesting that this could be both positively evaluated and negatively evaluated. That is yet another layer of meaning, so to speak. War is war. Well, yes, obviously. What I'm basically doing here is I'm saying twice the same thing. I'm saying twice the same thing. Okay? That's flouting the maxim of quantity. Why should I say twice the same thing? Why should I say either John will come or he will not? Well, yeah, obviously. If he does it, he does it. Both of these parts have the same truth conditions, the same content. Okay? We do this because we mean things like, well, terrible things happen in war, and that's just the way things are. Or we interpret these statements to mean something quite different. Relevance. If someone says, I do think Mrs. Jenkins is an old windbag, don't you? And if then B says, lovely weather for March, isn't it? I think you can see why this might happen. B doesn't want to answer the question, doesn't want to agree, possibly because Mrs. Jenkins has just entered the room, or her daughter, or whatever. And B and A will make this statement, or this utterance, lovely weather for March, relevant by assuming that B is still being cooperative. Although on the surface, he's not, or she's not. So it's made relevant in context. Okay. Few more slides. Flouting of the maxim of manner. This is something which I've tried out myself. It works to some extent until your children start spelling very well. Let's get the kids something. Okay, but I veto I-C-E-C-R-E-A-M-S. Okay. I'm quite obviously flouting the maxim of manner. It's produced in an odd manner. And this, obviously, you can see, might have to do with the fact that you don't want your child to find out that you're talking about ice cream, because the moment you say ice cream, you say, I want ice cream. Okay? So, the general message is, we are cooperative, or we assume we are cooperative, and if it looks as if we don't, we assume we're still cooperative. Yeah? And that's how we read the illocution, that's how we read the speech act into what is being uttered. Okay, we're back at the marriage thing again. Will you marry me? You lack confidence, you're clumsy, and let's be honest, you're not the brightest bulb around. Is that a yes or no? Okay. Now, quite obviously, someone didn't quite draw the right implicatures. Yeah? But this is basically an illustration of well, sometimes it's actually several maxims that are being flouted. She's saying too much. A yes or a no would have been enough. She's also saying things which are not immediately relevant to the question, one could argue, to a certain extent. Okay. Or look at this one. I'm going outside. Are you done with your homework? Yes. You read that whole chapter? Let's just leave it that I'm done. Back to your room, Buster. Okay. So I leave that to interpret. Leave that for you to interpret for yourself. But it's again on the basis of standard implicatures and interpreting what is being said on the assumption that people are being cooperative. Now, one area, and that's the final thing I would like to say for today, one area where these kind of principles, apart from jokes, where I guess this is one important area, but one where it is very important is the language of advertising. And in fact, we could have a whole lecture about the language of advertising, and it's quite an interesting field. You may have seen this one, Campbell soup, 1/3 less salt. Okay? That must be better. I'll buy it. Then what? 1/3 less salt than it used to have? 1/3 less than the soups of the competition? Or possibly than the Great Salt Lake? We don't know. Yeah? The implicature is less than, well, either those of the competition or than it used to have before, and that is good. But they don't say it's an implicature, it's not an entailment. It's something that's cancelable. Okay? If someone then gets into serious health trouble because they've eaten too much Campbell's soup and want to sue them, then Campbell's soup can say, yeah, but we never said X. Okay? I'm not sure whether they could get away with it, but that's basically the message, and that's the implicature that consumers draw. Engineered like no other car in the world. This was at some stage a slogan of Merck's. Well, yeah, obviously. It's a Merck. I'm sure, I don't know, Volvos are engineered differently. It's a different brand. It's a different company. Yeah? But the implicature, of course, here is better. Yeah? But that's not what it says. It's an implicature. This may be one of the most powerful cars in the world. Yeah? But then again, maybe not. Yeah? So we're just basically inviting implicatures on the part of the consumers, and consumers go for it and buy the cars and Campbell's soup, etc., etc. Okay, conclusion of this lecture. The important point to take home is, or are, all utterances, anything you say, including what you're chatting during my lecture, are speech acts. Have to bring it in. Okay? Somehow. Speech acts do not always correspond to the related sentence types, so imperatives, declaratives, and interrogatives. And when they do not correspond, then we have some level of indirectness. And this means we need to interpret things. Indirectness correlates to some extent with politeness, and more of this next time. And the most important bit is that all of this works because we assume that we are cooperative, and even if it looks as if we're not, we still assume that you're cooperative. Because otherwise communication wouldn't make sense. Why would someone want to communicate if they don't want to communicate? Okay. All right. That's the end of the pragmatics session, lecture.